The Association for Women's Rights in Development, AWID, has just wrapped up its 12th International Forum in Istanbul, Turkey. Two of Women's Magazine's reporters, Priti Mangala Shekhar and Margot Okazawa Ray, attended this international summit. AWID is an international feminist membership organization committed to achieving gender equality, sustainable development, and women's human rights. Priti found some time to sit down with award-winning Sri Lankan human rights activist and scholar Sunila Abesakara. Ms. Abesakara works with the Women and Media Collective in Sri Lanka and speaks widely in the international community. In this interview, Ms. Abesakara talks about the unseen challenges women face in putting their lives back together now that the 26-year civil war has ended and the international community has turned its attention elsewhere.
So could you begin by giving a very broad brushstroke of the post-conflict situation? 2009, the conflict officially ended, but there's been a lot of recent developments this year. Could you just share a quick broad brush update about it?
I think it's important to recall that the conflict ended with allegations of war crimes and crimes against humanity committed both by the government of Sri Lanka and the Liberation Tigers of Tamil Eelam. And those allegations have never been properly investigated. And even though, for example, the panel of experts that was established by the Secretary General of the UN in 2010 clearly stated that there was a solid basis for the allegations and that there should be an investigation. In the meanwhile, the human rights situation in the country has continued to deteriorate, you know, which is, it's really terrible when you think about it, because for so many years we had lived with the war and with all the devastation that the war brought to us. And I think there was some hope that even though the war was concluded in such a terrible way, you know, so many people who surrendered were killed, including the leadership of the LTT, and over 300,000 people were displaced. We still hoped that once the government had had achieved this level of confidence, right, this military victory, that they would then move into a second phase, which is what happens in most other post-conflict scenarios, right, that you have a process of reconstruction, rehabilitation, and reconciliation. And none of that has happened, and now it's 3 years since the end of the war. And I think the Prevention of Terrorism Act still remains in place. There are even today people who get detained under the PTA, and there continue to be abductions in broad daylight in Colombo. There continue to be dead bodies found in public places. The bodies of people who have been abducted turn up. Just yesterday I had news that one of the young Tamil men who was abducted from Jaffna, his body had turned up in a well. So there are a range of issues that are post-conflict that are even more worrying than, just the end of the conflict. And I think that's a very critical situation in which we in Sri Lanka are today, that there's a way in which the Tamil people's political aspirations have not been addressed at all, that the humanitarian condition of Tamil people who were displaced by the war has not been addressed. Tamil people's livelihoods, for example, livelihood and housing issues in particular, are still pending. And on top of that, Sinhalese and Muslim and Tamil people who live in the south of the country, who live in the areas that were not directly affected by the conflict, are also facing a lot of human rights violations and repression.
And it's the aggravated situation continues. What was during the conflict is kind of, it's post-conflict only in one sense then.
Yes, actually, we don't even want to talk about Sri Lanka being a post-conflict situation. It's a country in which the conflict ended and then nothing has happened since. I think it's also actually more difficult and more complicated after the conflict ended, because the government of our President Rajapaksa still rides on the triumphalism and is able to engage public opinion in the south of the country on the basis that, look, you know, we got rid of the LTTE, you can now go to work in peace, you don't have to worry about bombs in public places. All that is very true. But somehow, the war victory has enabled President Rajapaksa to project himself as the savior of the Sinhala majority. And as a president of the Sinhala majority, he no longer feels any compulsion to represent all Sri Lankans or to be the president of all Sri Lankans. He is perfectly happy to be the president of the Sinhalese people of Sri Lanka, and he makes no bones about it.
And you recently issued a statement along with two other activists about the Geneva resolution and the harsh the issues that you guys were facing, that the three of you
right.
were facing. Could you speak to that and also speak to your own work as a human rights defender mm-hmm. and your work on documenting some of these violations and trying to bring it to light?
Well, you know, I work with a documentation center that's based in Colombo. It's been operating since 1990, right? And so we've been doing documentation of human rights violations for a very long time. In the post-war scenario, we were, with many other groups, very concerned first about the immediate aftermath, the displacement, and the absolute lack of information about what had happened to people who surrendered, about what had happened to people who were arrested, about what were the conditions in terms of security for women in the IDP camps, and so forth. No? So we did what we could to gather information, to share it. At the national level, we shared it with the government, we shared it with the international community in Colombo, and we shared it with the UN human rights system, which is a place where we go to when we find that we're not able to get any justice or redress at the national level, right? And I think we already had expressed concerns about, especially the assassinations of Sarandis in May 2009. And then we followed a process in which we were continuing to raise the issue at different sessions of the UN Human Rights Council in Geneva. And the government very logically said, it's too soon, we're just trying to get everything in order. Then in 2010, the UN Secretary General appointed his committee. In 2011, the government appointed their own committee, the Lessons Learned and Reconciliation Commission, and then in November of 2011, the LLRC Commission's report was also available. And by March 2012, it was clear that the government was not going to move, was not going to investigate, was not interested in investigating, was still in a total triumphalist mode. And at that point, I think the geopolitical scenario worked in our favor. Because we had been in Geneva three times a year since 2009, right, on this issue. And we never got any traction because the international community was willing to buy the Sri Lankan government's plea, give us time. I think what happened in February, if you look at what was happening in South Asia in January and February of 2012, I think one of the key things was that there was a meeting in Islamabad between the heads of state of Iran, Pakistan, and Afghanistan. And I think it was not a meeting that received a lot of publicity, but it sent a lot of alarm bells ringing in Washington and in Delhi. At the same time, I think China represents a collective challenge to both the US and India. And I think the resolution that was brought in the UN Human Rights Council in March 2012, which calls on the government of Sri Lanka to implement the recommendations of its own commission, the Lessons Learned and Reconciliation Commission. It does not mention war crimes. It does not mention crimes against humanity. It says nothing except that the government should take action to implement the recommendations. Even that resolution was only possible because there was an alliance between India and the United States. And between those two powers, they managed to bring in the number of votes that was required to get the resolution passed in the Human Rights Council. The government of Sri Lanka, I think, originally did not anticipate that they would lose in the Human Rights Council. They were very confident of the bloc support of the non-aligned movement. And I think India's positioning in this whole debate was what made the, for example, the non-aligned movement's vote disintegrate and people voted country per country. I think the Sri Lankan government was overconfident. They didn't do their homework right. And when they discovered that, in fact, there was a strong chance that the resolution would go against them, they began a huge campaign against the Sri Lankan human rights defenders who were in Sri Lanka but also present in Geneva. And in particular, I think they targeted four of us, myself, Dr. Pakisothi Saravanamuthu from the Center for Policy Alternatives, Nimaka Fernando, who is the president of the International Movement Against Racism, and Sunanda Deshapriya, who is a Sinhalese journalist who is now living in exile in Switzerland. And from about the third or fourth, the Human Rights Council began its sessions on 27 February. From about the second or third of March, every day, on the television news, on the radio, in all the state-controlled press and electronic media, there were reports which showed the faces and said we were terrorists and we were traitors. Those are the two labels, you know. They did not attack us on any substantive base. They did not say anything really about the resolution. They just attacked us personally. And they also tried to make out to the general public in Sri Lanka that this was a resolution about war crimes and that we were going to take our president to The Hague. You know, so they lied about the text of the resolution and they vilified us.
So basically they just think that they can act, the government is, continues to believe that it can act with impunity because in the face of some international momentum right now that is quite historic, it continues to just do what...
Yes, I think we're very unfortunate as Sri Lankan civil society, and I think the predicament that we find ourselves in now is very reflective of how clever and strategic our president has been. He has completely fragmented and undermined the opposition to the point that we have no political opposition that's active. He imprisoned the commander who fought the war and won it. He has systematically attacked the media to the point that over 50 journalists have fled the country and are now living in exile, so the freedom of expression has been completely curtailed. So in that sense, you know, you have an open field. There's no one to criticize you. There's no one to oppose you. Why wouldn't you do what you want to do? You know, there's nothing to stop you.
How was the international media response? I know there was some pressure, some visibility around this.
I think this was a really good moment in terms of, as for us as human rights defenders, this was a moment in which everything that we had tried to do for the last 3 years came together in a way. The elders, you know, Nelson Mandela, Mary Robinson, Bishop Tutu, people like that, they issued letters. There was an op-ed in the New York Times, there were op-eds in the Indian press. There was quite, I mean, Channel 4 released its new film on Sri Lanka. So there was actually a very high level of reporting and focusing on Sri Lanka during this time. At the same time, I must say that this is the first time that we experienced the positive activism of a moderate Tamil diaspora from Canada, from England, and from the US, who lobbied with their politicians. In the British Parliament, they had a special debate. In the Australian Parliament, in the Malaysian Parliament. So the diaspora Tamil groups, for the first time, actually stepped a little aside from their call for Elam and separate state and tried to really focus on having some mechanism through which we could hold the Sri Lankan government accountable for human rights violations. And I think that was very, very influential in how things played out.
Did it die out around the resolution time, or do you think it will sustain and kind of build?
Well, I think that everyone who was engaged in the advocacy knows really well that the resolution in a way is just a beginning. In Sri Lanka, the president has already said clearly he's not committed to implement the resolution. On May 1st this year, on Workers' Day, he has called out a big demonstration in which he has said that the resistance to the UN resolution should be like the key theme. So it's really clear we have our work cut out in the months to come. We will go back to the Human Rights Council in June, in September. In November, the Sri Lankan government comes under the review of the Universal Periodic Review process, so we'll go in November, and we'll go back in March next year, because in March next year, the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights will have to report to the council. So we have to continue to go and be there and get the new information and keep on putting it out there.
I was wondering if you could speak, this is something you've written and spoken about extensively, the violence that women have faced during the conflict and the issues right now also that they continue to face in terms of lack of access to resources.
Well, I think that there is absolutely no doubt that there was sexual violence against women during the last months of the conflict. The Channel 4, the new Channel 4 film, has interviews with two women who are masked for their own protection. And we have met, and our colleagues have done interviews with women who have said that they were sexually violated during the time that the most intense part of the fighting was going on. We cannot bring this to light at this moment because we have absolutely no way that we can guarantee the safety of the women who speak out. And so we say, yes, it happened, but if you say, can you prove it? Can you bring me a victim? Then we say, no, we're not producing victims for the pleasure of, you know, some international media coverage when we don't know then what are we going to do with her afterwards, right? In addition, we have voiced our grave concerns about the violation and desecration of the dead bodies of women. There's some really horrendous footage, again in the Channel 4 film, just stripping the bodies of women and poking the bodies with gun butts and making all kinds of foul jokes and remarks, you know, and that is just unconscionable, right? It's horrific. It happened and it's on record. In addition, I think while the 300,000 plus people were in the IGP camps, we had reports of sexual violence and rape and also of demands of sexual favors, including from members of Tamil paramilitary groups who were tasked with providing security for the camps, right? So it's not only about the Sri Lankan military, it's also about Tamil paramilitary groups that work with the government. In the period of resettlement, it's 3 years now, the housing situation is really bad. Many, many women who are heads of household because of the death or disappearance of male family members live in small huts. Women constantly tell us the main issue that they face is that they don't have doors that they can secure. And so they are afraid to go to sleep because every 500 yards there's a military checkpoint with four military men there 24 hours a day. So there's a very high level of personal insecurity that women are experiencing. Women have also not been able to recover their livelihoods. Part of it is because the army has taken over running all the little shops and tea shops that used to be in the Vani area. So these women have lost that. Women who ran those small shops have lost their livelihood. But for the women who did farming and who did fishing in the inland waters, they don't have their boats, they don't have the possibility to plow their land, so they are actually destitute. It's a very bad situation. And access to many parts of the north, many parts of the Vanni where the fighting took place in the last months of the war, is still restricted. The presidential task force controls everything. And so only those NGOs and civil society groups that are willing to register with the presidential task force can have access. So of course there are people, and there are some restrictions. You cannot do any you can't do counseling. The groups that do counseling that have asked for permission to go have been refused. So we work with a network of nuns and priests. They are the ones who have access to the communities, and so a lot of the work that we do in those areas is not through direct access, but through indirect access and through working through the churches, because they remain the only ones who cannot be stopped from going to visit their parishes and holding their Sunday services, and they continue to be in touch with the communities.
Wow, that's amazing. That's been strategic subversive.
I think a key issue and a key challenge that we're facing right now is that of women and men who are girls and boys who are members of the LTTE, who were forcibly recruited, most of them, and especially in the last months of the war, school children who have then been taken into custody, identified as LTTE, given some vocational training, and just dumped back in their villages. It's a very terrible situation because they are not welcome. Sometimes even their families don't want them to come back home. And there is no program of reintegration. And especially for the young girls and women, you know, for them, it's not so easy to move out of family and village. The LT, as long as they moved into the LTT provided them with a very secure environment.
It was like a government job.
Yeah, it was, and it was like a family, you know. You had a place to sleep, food, everything, you know. So they're incapable of and surviving, and they have the label of being an ex-LTT cadre. And this is a very terrible
How many people, you know, how many?
Well, there are a few thousand of them.
So they can't reintegrate into
society? No, they can if there was a proper program of public education and programs that would enable them to set up some kind of livelihood and, you know, re-establish themselves in their villages in a way that didn't make them vulnerable to violence. You know, sometimes people in their villages who have suffered because of what the LTT did blame them. And there have been several cases in which LTT, young men who returned to their villages have been killed.
Listening to Women's Magazine on KPFA 94.1 FM and online at kpfa.org. We're listening to Priti Shekhar's interview with Sri Lankan feminist activist and scholar Sunila Abesakara. Coming up, Priti asked Ms. Abesakara about the usefulness of international conventions on women's rights, such as the Convention on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women, CEDAW, which the United States has not signed, and UN Security Council Resolution 1325. 1325 was passed in 2000 to guarantee the inclusion of a gender perspective in conflict resolution.
You just came from a session where you spoke about the instruments that we have in the international community, CEDAW, 1325. Do you still feel that they hold out, or is it in particular moments in time that they are useful tools to kind of push?
Well, I think it's really useful to have 1325 because it talks about a commitment to having women more present in peace building and conflict transformation processes, right? But there is no political will to implement it. And when it is implemented in a piecemeal fashion or in, in a manner of speaking, say tokenism, right? So you have a woman, or you have a few women in peacekeeping forces. But as long as there is no political will, even within the UN, I think the Security Council resolution remains fairly empty, especially in terms of women on the ground. If you look at the huge struggle that Afghan women are having to be a part of their peace process, if any, or any negotiations with the Taliban, Or if you look at the various issues that women in Nepal are facing, trying to become more key players in what is happening in Nepal right now, which is this process of creating a new constitution and so forth, you see that actually neither the international community nor the UN nor governments are willing to take that risk to put women out there. And if they're not willing to take the risk, then, you know, the possibilities for us to move ahead in these areas is very limited. And I think, I still think it's a huge pity, because we work and we encounter constantly women who have such insights and such political
sophistication.
When it comes to negotiating with armed groups and when it comes to winning real strategic gains for themselves and for their families and their communities, you know, and all that wisdom, all that learning, all that insight is lost because of the fact that political power is still held mm-hmm. in the hands of men, and men in uniforms and with guns most of the time. But I think one of the things that I find most encouraging is that women still continue to do the work that they do in building peace and transforming conflicts, because for them it's a matter of life and death and survival. So hopefully, you know, I mean, I'm always hopeful that there will come a time when all that wisdom can really be acknowledged and affirmed.
And as we are at this moment here talking about where's the money for women's rights? We're talking about that here at this forum. And we're trying to build more power and more resources for civil society where women are a huge force. So how do you think that can be really shifted, like you said? I mean, you identified the problem. Mm-hmm. There is a lot of resources and capacities that women bring and offer, but they need the political space and, you know, the political space to be able to do it. How do you see that changing? Do you see even institutions like the UN Women kind of enabling that? Or what is the next level?
Well, I think that certainly UN Women could enable it if they wanted to. One of the challenges that we're putting forward to the donor community, which is very present at the AWID Forum, for example, is that they have to learn to trust women more, and that they have to be willing to give institutional funding to women's groups rather than program funding. They need to be in there with women's groups for the long haul. They need to think beyond 3-year, 2-year cycles, you know. And I think that's a huge challenge because of issues of accountability and transparency and, you know, periodic reporting and all that. But I think there has to be also some kind of a paradigm shift in the way that funders perceive their role, and also funders frame their expectations from relationships and partnerships with women who are living in very trying and difficult circumstances in countries, mm-hmm. like, you know, that are particularly countries that are in conflict.
Right. And the linked question is, you've spoken about this before, the need for a younger generation to step up and take up more leadership, and the lack of the current vacuum that you kind of indicated. What does it take to fill that, or to kind of nurture a more visionary leadership among the younger generations of activists, feminists as well as other social justice activists?
Well, I think in the first place we have to understand that the visioning of a younger generation of feminists will be very different from our own visioning. I come from a generation that grew up I was young in 1975 when the Vietnam Communist Party defeated the US Army, right? It's no longer possible. The young people today grew up in a different world. There are ways in which the new technology makes so much available to them in a way that was never available to us. I always tease younger women and say, do you know we organized the Women's Tribunal at Vienna at the World Conference on Human Rights in 1993, when most women did not even have access to a fax machine, right? We had to write letters. Now everything is possible with the new technology in terms of keeping in touch, knowing what's going on. So I think it's a different time. It's a different time in history. And sometimes I think also older feminists, we are afraid to let younger women take leadership because we don't want to take the risk. You know, we think we should guide them more. We should, and I just say, you know, step back, because everyone needs to make their own mistakes and make a mess of it and then figure it out. The politics has to be right. That's the most important thing. And the politics, I think, a lot of the younger women that I've heard speaking here at the AWID Forum, for example, have really brilliant politics. They're very aware of the world. Actually, they have a much broader grasp of the political scenario than we ever did, because they combine the concerns of indigenous communities and of women with disabilities. You know, if I look back to Beijing, you know, the issue of women with disabilities was just vaguely coming onto the agenda, and now here they are, you know, in your face with their claims, and younger women have to deal with it. So I think younger women are dealing with a much more complex world, and they're doing it really well, and they're using social media really well, and so we can retire.
Well, that's a great note to end the discussion on, unless you have any other issues you'd like to discuss. Yeah, I mean, I think so. I think there's been an opportunity for younger feminists to learn from the mistakes of the past and to be more inclusive. Intersectionality has been, as much as it sounds very academic and dense, has been helpful in kind of breaking down all the things we have. Could you speak to women's organizing and resistance in the current scenario? What is there a lot happening? Is it largely relying on NGO funding, or because the government is not doing anything and there are no resources?
One of the most interesting and positive things about Sri Lanka is that through all the years of the war, there have been some women's organizations that have tried to stay in touch and work across the ethnic divides and the geographic divides. And those relationships have been sustained through all these years of war and separation. So this year, 2012, in March, while we were busily fighting in Geneva, the women's groups from the south, there's a coalition called Mothers and Daughters of Lanka. They went as a group, probably it was a little, maybe 80 women, I think, as far as I can recall. They went to Mulatevu and to Kilinochi, to the Vani, to the war-affected areas, and spent the day with some of the women there. And again, it was facilitated by the nuns who worked there. And I think it was really a challenging trip to undertake, but it was also, I think people came back feeling very positive on both sides. We had really positive feedback, right? So I think there are small initiatives that are really positive that are totally unfunded. The government doesn't have, of course, any funding for this. And in Sri Lanka, partly the international funding has dried up because we're not at war anymore. You know, the war ends and the international community walks away.
Preeti Shekhar spoke with Sunila Abe Sakara, award-winning human rights activist and scholar from Sri Lanka. Their conversation took place at the annual gathering of the Association for Women's Rights and Development in Istanbul, Turkey.